Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Back Half, the New Statesman's Culture Podcast with me, Tom.
And me, Kate.
Kate, there was a little bit of a buzz around our corner of the office yesterday when the trailer for the new Freddie Mercury biopic was put out. Did you have a look at it?
I did have a look. A film that we never thought was going to be made and still may not be made somehow.
Has this been...
Maybe they've just made a trailer.
Has this been in the works for years then?
For, well, at least since 2010.
Right.
Famously Sacha Baron Cohen.
Yes, of course. Yeah, I'd kind of completely forgotten that.
Yeah, Brian May later described as an arse. So they basically fired Sacha Baron Cohen because Queen are just very difficult to work with and they want to protect the legacy of Freddie. And their idea of doing that is to sort of, to a certain extent, not show his wildness and not focus on his death and all that kind of thing. Anyone who's working with them is in a difficult bind because it's like you've got to do this very kind of cleaned up version of his life.
Is that because they don't want him to overshadow the achievements of the band, or is that because they want to protect his...
There'll be a bit of wanting to protect it, but there's also, of course, the question that they've been continuing without him since 2001
right.
now.
So and it's not the end of Queen.
Well, yeah. No, exactly. And if you look at interviews with them after he died, they're sitting there saying there's absolutely no way we can continue. This is it. And then somehow they've recalibrated their brains to the idea that actually it was just the Freddie phase of Queen that ended in 1991, and Queen has been a strong and powerful force ever since. So there's a bit of that going on, I think.
There's a bit of the sort of Alan Partridge, like, not sure about the Beatles, but Wings. There's a band you can get behind. Freddie Mercury era Queen, not so sure. Post-Freddie, yes, bring it on.
Patchy. Yeah. I did watch the trailer, and it was really bizarre to see these kind of rather... strange-faced, ugly actors playing the band. Not that they're a pretty band, because they're not, but you're so used to the sort of shapes of their faces and Brian's long nose and Roger's pretty face and Freddie's teeth. And it's just very discombobulating to watch actors playing them. But one thing that I did think is that they really got the voices quite good, the talking voices. Mm. So the only bit of dialogue in the trailer is Freddie saying in his strange, clipped kind of Indian posh accent, "This is where the opera section comes in," and then Brian May going, "The opera section." But I mean, I can't do their voices, but it sounds exactly like them. So it's like they've really worked on the intonation. But yeah, there's no suggestion from the trailer what the film's actually about.
Yeah.
It's just sort of scenes of him on stage with some dramatic
and
drum beats.
Presumably is Queen is behind it then. So they will, it's not one of those mad ones where there will be no Queen music in it.
No, they're totally behind it. Exactly, that's the problem of most rock biopics, is they're not allowed any, like that terrible Jimi Hendrix one.
Oh, I liked that.
Which just has him like doing one wow, wow on the guitar and then it changes scene because they couldn't get any real Hendrix music.
But I think they got away with that by kind of putting it in a very early, it was like right at the beginning of his career, wasn't it, coming to London?
Yeah.
Divided the audience.
I feel like the Queen one, I may be wrong about this, but I think it finishes at Live Aid or something like that. Or it sort of focuses on Live Aid.
But that's not even what we're talking about today.
No.
But we do have quite a heavily music-themed episode of the podcast today. We will be talking about the Arctic Monkeys without the definite article. Spent all week subbing out the definite article for mentions of Arctic Monkeys in the magazine. Arctic Monkeys' new album, Hotel Tranquility Hotel Base and Casino.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Amazing, yeah.
Fictional kind of space station hotel.
If you sort of sing it in your head, you can get it right. And
we'll also
what
be
else?
Talking about Mood Music, which is the new play by Joe Penhall on at the Old Vic, which is about a kind of creative differences case within the music industry, which we went to see last night. And we've got our 50 millionth non-anniversary, the cultural event of no great significance.
So, Kate, we went to see Mood Music at the Old Vic last night. This is a new play by Joe Penhall, who it's got a pretty varied career, actually. He did the film adaptation of Cormac McCarthy's The Road at one end of the spectrum, and then at the other end, the Kinks musical Sunny Afternoon.
Did he do that too?
Yeah.
And then most recently...
And your favourite.
The Mindhunter.
Yeah.
The Mindhunter. The Mindhunter. The Mindhunter, which was the look at, you know, the history of criminal profiling on serial killers.
So it's quite a good, it's quite a kind of broad career.
Yeah.
So what's he focused on here?
Well, in this he's focusing on a story of a young protege and a very successful record producer who's probably in his mid-40s, late-40s, fictional, both of them, who get into a big legal wrangling over the... over sort of intellectual copyright theft of songs between one another. And it turns into this very intense, very focused play where there are two therapists involved as well, delving into the motivations behind both the characters for entering the music industry in the first place. And there are also two lawyers who are trying to set up these cases against one another. And Ben Chaplin plays the main music producer himself, and they've obviously gone out to John Varvatos and they've kitted him out in perfect music industry wear, like those kind of jeans that are expertly distressed and hang just the right way.
John Varvatos being the rock couturier.
Yes, the dresser of the stars.
Yeah.
He's got Converse on and he's got a kind of strange leathery sort of shirt, and he's even got his glasses clipped on his collar in exactly the right way, and a load of bracelets.
He did have
as well.
Bracelets, yeah.
And he walks around in this kind of very teenage fashion. And one of my favourite lines in the whole play is that one of the therapists points out that cognitive development stops when you get famous. So a lot of 17-year-olds are trapped in the body of middle-aged men in the music industry.
His social cognition may be retarded.
Retardation is common within the industry. Yeah. To look at first off, you just think this is utterly convincing.
Yeah, he was totally convincing, and he's taken on this young singer from Dublin called Kat, played by Shauna Kerslake, and he's a musical hero of hers. This guy, his name is Bernard, which just makes me think of Guess Who. Because I took my kids to this comedy thing recently and we had to play a live version of Guess Who. But the comedian kept on saying that whenever he played Guess Who, it was always Bernard.
Bernard. Didn't he have a ginger toupee and a moustache? Yeah. Why did that stick out in the memory?
So Bernard is a musical hero of hers. So she's kind of thrilled to be working with him at last. And they actually do produce some music and they have a hit. And then it just... the relationship unravels, and Ben Chaplin, as the play goes on, Ben Chaplin shows you just how sort of poisonous a character this guy is. And it's sort of his play, isn't it? I mean, he gets the best lines. He's really, as a character, he kind of dominates the stage.
Yeah.
I mean, which is appropriate because that's what his character does. He dominates the room he's in.
One of his lines that chilled me the most as the kind of true sort of emptiness of his personality is revealed. He shouts at her, "Good songs do not have a heart, they have a void."
Mm.
There is a void at the center of them and we fill it with our own emotions.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's the most nihilistic thing you could possibly say about the most beautiful thing in the world, which is music. So it's this dichotomy of like this thing that has the same stimulus in your mind as the feelings of love, and then a lot of the very damaged people that create it. And I thought that was one of the most powerful things in the whole concept, that, you know, it pulls people in who have holes within them, who have difficult lives, who are kind of mining themselves for suffering, and then it creates something which other people take enormous comfort in and think is wonderful and great. I think it really nailed that.
But it's a great motif for the whole play, actually. But he's an interesting one because he is sort of, it comes up at one point, but he's sort of a borderline psychotic character. So he definitely has a void in his heart, but there's no sense that the music itself is actually filling it in any way. So although he's getting, you know, he gets succor from his success, he's not actually, there's sort of no emotional connection with the music whatsoever.
Yeah, she says, I'm trying to do something fresh and different. He says, I'm trying to make a hit record. Yeah. So really, that's the motivation. What I loved was the way it's straight in at the deep end with the nitty-gritty of what this kind of copyright theft thing is all hooked around, which is that she's written a song and she's playing him an opening chord progression on the piano. He comes in and he tells her to put suspensions on some of the chords, meaning that taking the idea of the consonant notes, which is that everything sounds kind of rounded and satisfying and nice to the ear, and then changing the harmonics underneath them to create a feeling of tension and weirdness and stuff. So he's told her to do this. And then, of course, when the whole thing kicks off, he says, well, it was my idea for you to put those suspensions on those chords. And she says, but they were my chords in the first place. So once you're dealing with that kind of level of intricacy, you think, oh my God, it's such a gray area, this whole business of music plagiarism. Like, who came up with it first and whose idea influenced that note or that note?
It's really good that, because it actually brings in these sort of very specific and legalistic ideas without ever kind of slowing down the action. And I should say, I don't want to get too deep into it, but I should just say that the action is really, I was thinking about this afterwards, really expertly and elegantly choreographed, given that you've got Bernard and Kat, but you have these two lawyers and these two therapists working around them. And the dialogue intercuts constantly. And occasionally you even get people sort of chipping in on other people's scenes. But for most of the play, I was sort of completely, it just worked naturally for me. I was sort of barely aware of it, which is a real sign that works, I think.
Yeah, there'll be a moment where actually they address each other in the middle of their kind of separated court case kind of scenes. And you realize that that's harking back to them in the studio in the better days, kind of 6 months earlier. And it's totally effortless the way that happened.
Another kind of big theme of the play is Kat says, when she's getting very exasperated, she's saying, if I write a riff, people assume he wrote it. Men write riffs, not women. It drives me mad. People always assume a man wrote the songs. That rings true, definitely, doesn't it? That you get the sense that people are much more willing to believe that, you know, an Adele or someone like that needed help in the recording studio, whereas, you know, Ed Sheeran probably just does it all on his guitar.
One of the main things that's sort of stoking that belief is that we're interested in the craft of songwriting now in these kind of camps and the way that sort of a Katy Perry or somebody is encouraged to write a song. And it always starts off with what they call a kind of almost like a pseudo-therapy session, where the young artist, often a female artist, will come in and talk about the issues in her life that have been troubling her. And you have this idea, whether it's true or not, that they take one or two choice lines from that sort of so-called therapy session, and then they work them up into a chorus. So it always starts from the point of emotion, in inverted commas.
And is that then, kind of like how, so Adele's Rolling in the Deep was with Paul Epworth? And like, I think that was kind of, they sat down and wrote that together. But I think it is quite, it's a very emotional song and feels quite personal as well.
Yeah, and I know I've interviewed Egg White once, who did Chasing Pavements and Warwick Avenue for Duffy and stuff. And it is, maybe it's part of the sort of perpetuation of this idea that you always start from, well, you know, what was hurting her at that point and what was her latest relationship and stuff. And yeah, sure, that's gonna kick off the album because the album's got to be about the singer. But it doesn't mean that the singer isn't writing the riffs. So actually, there was a study done last year that revealed that of the 600 most popular songs in the last 5 years, only 12.3% of them were written by women. This was like University of Arizona or somewhere like that did this study. And you're thinking, yeah, but how do we know? Like, after plays like this, how do we really know who wrote what? Who wrote what chord, you know?
The crisis with this is that he's such a stubborn, psychotic character that he will not give her any credit on the songwriting. But when you, if you look up songs, you know, like Chasing Pavements or Rolling in the Deep or any of these, often there'll be a co-writing credit, you know, often with the producer or if not another songwriter. And of course, you know, unless you were in that room, And even if you were in that room, you've got no idea whether is that a 50-50 split? Is it a 60-40? Is it a 70-30 split?
Or is it tiny on the songwriter?
Like, yeah.
I mean, look at Beyoncé's songwriting camps. She has them and everyone goes and lives there for 10 days. And she walks in and out of rooms going, I like that line. I don't like that one. It's not that necessarily she's writing that line, but she's giving her thumbs up or down to it. And that involves her then getting a credit among five other people on the writing of the song.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy. So I can see it from both ways. It must be frustrating if the artist didn't do anything. But he points out in the play that they use kind of the idea of creative control as a carrot now to get young artists into record contracts. And sometimes it's just bollocks. It's just there on paper to like make out like you're involved when you're not.
In some ways, the whole thing is sort of 2 hours of extreme mansplaining, isn't there? I mean, he's so awful and oppressive in the way that he, you know, she's obviously talented. And he gets these young singers in by telling them they're the most exciting singer he's ever heard. And then then that tap's turned off and the mansplaining tap is turned on. And it's painful to watch the scenes that start off as mansplaining and then go into kind of almost borderline psychological torture, where he's sort of getting her to play a kind of three, four rhythm guitar sequence and saying that she's not counting three properly. And then he gets a cowbell out and starts banging it in her ear, counting three.
And then when she does it stronger, he's like, I didn't want to fucking waltz.
Yeah, faster, louder, stronger, quieter.
One thing I did struggle with it, and this is just the problem of trying to, I mean, Rachel Cook wrote about this in her review of the Picasso program about on National Geographic. The idea of portraying creativity on stage or on screen is just really, really difficult. I didn't get any particular sense of them dovetailing at all musically. I mean, not only is it obviously not possible to listen to the songs at length that they're making, but there was that feeling of, God, they're interrupting each other after 2 or 3 seconds and arguing over every creative step. That doesn't feel to me like a natural kind of musical bond or something. But maybe that's just hard to, I don't know.
I think it is hard to show, isn't it? And the interest for them was obviously in the souring of the relationship. But yeah, I think they could have possibly done more to show what it might have been like when it was working. Because they're supposed to have written hit records together. The other thing to say about it is just that there are a couple of just great lines in this play. Ben Chaplin's character, you know, I mean, he makes the usual jokes about drummers and bassists and things, but on singers, you know, they have to project into a song sensitivity and complexity and tremendous feeling, when quite often they're actually quite thick. Singers have to empty their minds in order to sing. And then they stay that way. You know, some really good punchlines.
Drummers can't feel pain. They're like fish. Yeah. But that's, again, that was a slight kind of took slight issue with this. It's a bit like watching Mindhunter in that the men get the great lines, right? Yeah. The men are fully fleshed out, three-dimensional, fascinating, charismatic characters with hints of psychotic behavior.
Mm.
And the women are, in her case, she's very troubled, but she doesn't have any funny lines.
No.
She's upset all the time, and her female therapist is also quite a bland character, and the male therapist is
very
much
bland.
More witty.
Yeah.
And I think maybe his interest is in, he really likes psychopaths. That's his area of expertise.
Yeah.
And he's looking at psychopaths in Mindhunter or in the music industry, and maybe he could cover himself by saying, there are more psychopath men than there are women. That's who I'm getting into here.
Mm.
But he could have done, she could have been a lot more of a playful and stronger character, I thought.
At one point, she sort of crosses her eyes and sticks out her tongue at him. But I completely agree, especially on the therapist, where the male therapist is quite developed and actually comes out with some quite probing, interesting stuff. He basically ends up sacking Ben Chaplin because he's not getting anywhere with him. The female therapist is very much of a kind of, how does that make you feel?
Yeah. So, and also really struggling with her emotion. Like she feels like she was kind of trying to suppress fright at her charge a lot of the time, or anger and stuff. And I thought that's strange for a therapist. But
do we know if he was inspired by any real cases of
he
this
says
sort of
not, but
relationship?
It's been... it's been suggested there's an awful lot of Keisha and Dr. Luke in this, and also, you know, in terms of the psychological.
So that's the American sort of singer-rapper who sued her producer for kind of emotional abuse and sexual abuse.
Yeah. So there isn't necessarily any hint of that in this.
Yeah.
And he wrote this before Me Too and everything.
Right.
It's just a brilliantly timed thing. And also, I think the lines, of course, about people not thinking that women are writing the music. That's heavily inspired by Bjork's point about people not believing that she was programming her own beats and doing her own engineering and electronics and stuff like that. So yeah, it has been flying around for a while.
I think it's helped that it was written before the Me Too stuff, but it can't help but chime a little bit, you know, when he gets up after he's winning this Ivor Novello and he does all this, and it was a little bit overdone this, but, you know, he's like, music is beyond gender. There's no sexism in music. Music's just a feeling, you know, and like, you know, obviously now music is gender and politics. It's barely anything else but gender and politics and race and all these things.
Penhall says that he doesn't think that the music industry is inherently patriarchal. He thinks it's the commercial aspect of it that does all this damage. So it is literally about what will sell, and everyone's under the same pressure of selling. So that was kind of an interesting point. And I don't know if he's right. I mean, I think Lily Allen came out recently saying that, you know, there just need to be a lot more female producers in the industry to kind of redress these sort of problems. But
God, that's a really obvious point, but actually quite a compelling one, because presumably, you know, it's the same in the film industry. Although the talent is often female, the directors and producers are so often male.
I mean, there's half a dozen working female producers, I think, in pop in this country. There's very, very few. I mean, I may be wrong about that.
Yeah.
They, in terms of the names,
they're not
that common.
Yeah. So Mood Music is on at the Old Vic until 16th of June.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Kate, you've been listening to Tranquility Base Hotel and Casino by Arctic Monkeys this week, and you've reviewed it in the magazine. What's your takeaway?
It's their sixth record.
And quite a long time since... Five years.
So I think he went over to LA. I feel like it's around 2013 or something. And the last one was, there was a Josh Homme presence on the last one and the previous one. And they were kind of much more riff driven, kind of desert rock, lots of bangers, lots of live songs. And this one, he's sort of sat down at a Steinway that someone gave him for his 30th birthday, which puts it all into perspective. Someone gives you a Steinway.
His manager, yeah. I think he came back from a 30th birthday trip and opened the door and there was the Steinway in his house.
Probably white on a sheepskin rug, I'd imagine, with a line of cocaine on the top. And
I imagine it in a sandpit like Brian was.
Yeah. And he wrote these tracks, which is kind of, he was interested by the idea that science fiction allows you to explore very close issues in a slightly different setting, just slightly removed from your own. So it's not a kind of wild and wacky thing. And he lives in LA and that's kind of like science fiction to English people anyway. He wrote this collection of songs and then he took them to the band. And the drummer, I think it was, said, this is a solo record. And he argued back. So the band played on it and they got like half a dozen other people out of Tame Impala and everything playing on there. To me, it's kind of fascinating album, and it definitely sounds like an Alex Turner solo album.
Yeah.
What did you think?
Well, let's hear a little bit of it first. This is 4 stars out of 5.
Take easy for a little while, come and stay with us. It's
sorry, that wasn't 4 stars out of 5. That was 4 out of 5. No stars. But the key line in that is...
Because he sings 4 stars.
Yeah, the key line is 4 stars out of 5, but he dropped that for the title for some reason. I actually love this record. I'm deep into it now. It's not really an Arctic Monkeys record. I think you're absolutely right. But it resets one of the things that was so appealing about them in the first place, which is his lyrical, I won't say genius, but his real knack for smart, witty, clever, knotty lyrics. And I guess he's now 12 years older.
Yeah.
I think it was 2006 they started.
Yeah.
So he's not singing about dance floors and stuff. He's singing about the films he's watching and the books he's reading. And it's a really like dense, erudite, packed record. But it sort of nods back to the origins of the band as well. You know, the first line on the first song is, "I just wanted to be one of the Strokes," which is a great opener. The sound of it is initially a bit kind of jarring, but I think it kind of creates its own sound world in a really effective way.
What are you feeling about the voice? Because I just find the voice inherently difficult, but actually once you stick with it for a couple of tracks, when I first put it on, I was like, who really lies down on a sofa and enjoys listening to Alex Turner's voice with a cup of tea? I know people do, but it's so exaggerated now, and
yeah.
It's so rich, and I keep thinking it's like drinking Baileys or something like that. It's got that cloying kind of thing, but also to me it just sounds more and more like 70s Lennon in a kind of brilliant way, like in a sort of particularly with the American connection now, that sort of sealed off, strange,
yes,
spacey place that he's in. With, he's lost his accent a bit, and he's sort of, everything's a bit slower. There's less trying to cram gags in, you know, throwing puns and lines over your shoulder and stuff. It's much more measured. And it just feels like a much more mature character singing. I love the sense of alienation in it. I love that line about, he's really captured something about the tyranny of modern pop culture. He says something like, we're all floating on a barge down an endless stream of great TV.
Yeah.
And that, I feel that about, like, you know, every new Netflix thing. I'm thinking like, what can we do? We can't say they're good or bad. We can literally just run to catch up with them. That's what we do. And journalism's turning into people just narrating what television shows are about rather than saying whether they're any good or not. And I just love that. And I also love the line sort of echoes somebody saying to him, "What do you mean you haven't seen Blade Runner?"
Yeah, that was fantastic.
And I read an interview with him where he said, he loves it when people say that kind of thing to him, because he loves the kind of the jar of what they think he is like compared to what he really is. "No, I haven't seen it. What are you talking about?"
No, and you can imagine him just writing all these things down. There's also a great bit where there's a whole kind of sequence where he talks about a great new documentary that he's just seen, and he's been listening to the soundtrack in his car, and the opening sequence is fantastic and stuff. And it's just, it's brilliant. And there is a bit of a persona to it, which... I mean, he's weirdly said it is really autobiographical. And he said in an interview I read, he said that the 11 songs were like him having a word with himself intermittently over 11 tunes. But you're right about 70s Lennon. I think I was thinking about the kind of reference points for this, and they are all 70s. He loves Dion. He loves Dion's mid-70s period. It reminded me a bit of Surf's Up by the Beach Boys, 1971, like that really rich Van Dyke Parks lyrics and kind of slightly freaky, spacey sound. He's also a bit obsessed with Serge Gainsbourg's Histoire de Melody Nelson.
So it's the French lounge
they recorded
and the American
France,
lounge
yeah.
rather than the English Tony Christie, Richard Hawley kind of lounge.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah, you're right. I can't remember whether you just said this or wrote it in your piece, but you sort of pick it up expecting it to sound a bit like Richard Hawley. And
yeah,
it's
I just thought it was going to sound a lot more, I just, you know, something very kind of pert and contained about his melodies a lot of the time, and quite sort of sweet about them. And then you're just listening out for the sort of barbs in the words. And this is just bizarre. I mean, it changes time signatures all the time. They're written on the piano, and you can hear when songs are written on the piano because they meander in weird ways. Like, there's no one there to rein him in. And I just think it's interesting that the reviews of it have been quite mixed, and some people struggle with this sort of sense of musical experimentation because they think that means an artist has lost their way. But I think they're finding it. Like they're kind of going, well, where can I go next? You know.
Any other favourite lines from the record?
I like the one, I'm never very good at remembering full lines, but I like the one where he says something, sort of hanging around in my underpants, I might form a covers band.
I've got it here. Do we?
Go on, do it.
Dancing in my underpants, I'm going to run for government, I'm going to form a covers band.
Yeah.
Back there by the baby grand, did Mr. Winter Wonderland say, come here, kid, we really need to talk. Bear with me, man, I lost my train of thought.
That is the proper, that's the young genius rock star who's facing potentially being washed up in Los Angeles, like isolated from home, and what do you do next? And are you still a genius? And, you know, I think it's just, it's almost reminds me of that kind of risky business scene, I suppose, the dancing in the underpants, a huge mansion with him rattling around in it.
Yeah, or like you say, like John Lennon in his New York apartment, wherever it was, on the umpteenth floor, like near Central Park, kind of, again, like you can imagine him like wandering around in his underpants. Yeah.
I have to say that the more I become interested in him as an emerging musician, the more I just wish he would attach himself to some kind of political cause and use his ability to write amazing couplets and one-liners to kind of do something a bit more, you know, focused on something other than himself. And it's sort of, it's weird that you want that to be, I just think he could do something amazing if he actually got, you know.
Yeah, because he's got that ability to skewer and satirize, hasn't he? I mean, another great line in Batphone, I launched my fragrance called Integrity to sell the fact that I can't be bought.
He could do great things,
yeah.
But he doesn't have to, because maybe like our producer in Mood Music, he was frozen at the age of 19, suffering some kind of retardation of the mind. Who knows? He's obviously able to continue creating good stuff. But
yeah, I mean, I guess if you're in your 30s and living in LA with your supermodel girlfriend, then, you know, that's great in some ways.
Yeah, it's great. Why should he be doing anything else? Yeah. Okay, he did on the advice of a friend, he was told to stop writing about love for this album, which I thought was great.
The good advice, I think.
Yeah.
Because the love stuff had got, I mean, it wasn't really about, it was all about sex anyway, wasn't it?
There's
not much love in Arctic Monkeys records. Like, AM is all, you know, and the one before, Come and Have a Spin on My Propeller, it's all that kind of like, it's all that really fairly blunt sex metaphor stuff. Anyway, Tranquility Base Hotel and Casino is out now on Domino Records.
So Tom, you have our non-anniversary for us this week.
Let me just consult the non-anniversary files. The non-anniversary this week, Kate, is Willow, which was released 30 years ago this week.
This minute.
Thereabouts, May 20th, 1988. Collaboration between George Lucas and Ron Howard. So Ron Howard, who had just directed Cocoon, I think, and wanted to do a fantasy film. Lucas, who'd had this story sitting around since Star Wars to do a kind of proper sword and sorcery film, and the two of them, and they'd worked together on American Graffiti, which Lucas directed, and Ron Howard. Have you seen American Graffiti?
No.
Oh my God.
I can't believe it's, you haven't seen Blade Runner.
It's just wonderful. And I love Ron Howard. And he in American Graffiti, he plays a kind of more serious version of the character he plays in Happy Days. You know, preppy kid.
Hadn't Lucas
also got Harrison Ford in it?
Oh,
in a brilliant role. Sorry,
Lucas had worked with Warwick Davis before, right? So he was in Return of the Jedi. He played an Ewok.
He played an Ewok in Return of the Jedi, and that's when he said, "I think you'd be good in."
His exact words, wasn't it? I thought it'd be great to use a little person in the lead role.
Because his films are all about the little person against the system. Yeah, I think the trailer is like, heroes come in all shapes and sizes. It's a kind of, you know, it's a sort of weird Jesus narrative, actually. Baby will save the world, which has been cursed by some evil sorceress. And Baby ends up in the hands of Warwick Davis, who's a sort of trainee magician, who then teams up in a classic little and large combo with Val Kilmer, who's actually really funny as a kind of dopey mercenary who sort of keeps on trying to impress people and falls over, and has this very, very 80s, like, I can't really describe it, but like two like little braids coming down from his hair.
Just on one side.
Just two thin braids, yeah.
Did you like it at the time?
Yeah, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And it's a real, it's a very kid-oriented, I mean, it's become a cult classic. But it's really it's for kids basically. And there's all this sort of comic relief from these like tiny, they're called brownies, like little sprite figures who completely unexplained but speak in French accents. Which in retrospect, I think it's quite a good decision.
Nowadays, you'd have to explain that, wouldn't you? There'd be Guardian think pieces about why they're French.
But
is it racist?
The interesting thing about this is that no one wanted to distribute it because fantasy films don't sell. That was the thinking at the time. Even though Star Wars had been a huge hit, they didn't. They're like, okay, sci-fi sells now. Even though at the time of Star Wars, people were like, this is going to be a complete disaster, and there'd been a few like commercially unsuccessful fantasy films, including Labyrinth, which is of course now another cult classic.
What about Neverending Story then, Dark Crystal and things like that? Do you think, or were they later?
I don't know. I don't
feel like
know.
They were late 80s as well.
They were possibly later, and they may have come, you know, after, because this was a commercial success. And so this may have kind of slightly kickstarted a bit of a that kind of like family fantasy genre. But yes, Willow, happy 30th birthday, Willow. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Back Half. We will be back in a fortnight. In the meantime, do get in touch. I'm on Twitter and we have an email address. Email technology.
Email us some abuse, please.
Which is thebackhalfpodcast@gmail.com. Mm. We've been edited by Caroline Crampton. Thanks to Domino Records for the Arctic Monkeys clip. And we're not going to play you out with Arctic Monkeys.
We're going to play you out with our regular end music. That makes it sound really exciting. I could have bolstered this up a bit. Our bollock bashing pistol jazz with Godspeed.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.